The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab for Monday, June 29th, 2015. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, your tips, and your cool stuff found. We answer as much as we possibly can, share as much as you send us or as we come up with. And the goal is for us all together to learn several new things each time we get together and have some fun doing it. Some of you folks have even described us as click and clack of the Apple world, and we'll take it. We like it. That's a good one. A couple of sponsors for this episode. Connected Data, the makers of the Transporter, have a new coupon code for us to share with you. MGG75 saves you $75 off of a 1 or 2 terabyte Transporter model. We'll talk about that and personal cloud a little bit later in the show, including a little story that we have that happened this weekend, actually, about the Transporter. iMazing at iMazing.com. One of the best apps we've found to manage the data on your iOS devices. Coupon code MGG saves you 20% there. We'll talk more about that. Also, Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Build your website and build it beautiful, and use coupon code MGG to save you 10% here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And here in another part of Durham, New Hampshire, right next to Dave, is Pilot Pete. Glad to be here, guys. It's been a while.
It's great to have you back, Pete.
Yeah, it's nice being had.
Yeah. In fact, the last podcast you were on went out.
You were there.
I was there. That's true. Yeah, it was the one that
was John.
As was John. That's right. But it wasn't ours. It was the MyMac show that happened at Barry Falk's house at after MacStock at the barbecue that we talked about last week.
Just a podcast whore, Dave. What can I say?
Hey, it's all right, man. You're getting like Jeff Gamet. You're on every show. Yeah. That's awesome. So, how goes it with you, Mr. Braun?
I'm a little under the weather. So, pardon me if I'm not up to my usual energetic.
We'll get you
on topic
there,
self.
That's awesome.
Maybe I'll be up more on topic than usual. I do have something new and exciting, Dave, though.
Go ahead.
Is directly related to our new workflow.
Yeah.
And I'm going to include a tip in this. So you may recall, so we're using Evernote now, and I was grumbling in a prior show that I couldn't really see what was happening. Number one, I'm, getting along in years, as we all are. But also, number two, Dave, I had this relatively puny little screen, a Samsung SyncMaster 191T Plus 1280x1024 that I must have gotten 10 years ago. And it served my needs well, but I figure, you know what? It's time to get with it. Yes, I got it in 2004, believe it or not. And oh my gosh, you know what I paid for it, Dave? I paid, and this was a good price back then, $640.
Okay.
That was a good price for a Samsung 19-inch LCD.
It was. It's true. Wow. Yeah.
But then I'm like, you know what? I need a bigger screen. So I checked the specs for the Mac Mini here. The Mac Mini can support up to 1920 by 1200. And then I got an email from Amazon Warehouse Deals. So like a lot of places, kind of like Apple, they sell, I'd say it's their refurb store. Open box specials and stuff like that. And so I looked through to see what they had, to see if I could save a couple of bucks. And yes, I did. So what I have right now, Dave, which more than meets my needs here, and it's supported on the Mac Mini, I got a 24-inch Asus at 1920 by 1080, so not quite the full resolution, but certainly good enough. So, and it's also wide screen, or wide form factor, $130.
That's awesome. You got a link for us that you'll put in the show notes there?
I can find a link for the refurb store. The things come and go, ebb and flow.
Okay,
but I did want to offer something. So I plugged in the screen and displayed it the resolution that I wanted, but I was like, you know what? Something doesn't look quite right. Why is that? And I found out why, Dave. So I was looking. So in System Preferences, Displays, you're going to see two tabs. You're going to see a Display tab, And what that's going to let you do, it'll let you choose the resolution. It may say default for display, or you could say scaled, in which case it'll give you some other resolutions for the display. But then there's another thing, Dave, color. When I clicked on color, what was highlighted was not this monitor, which is a VS248, but what was highlighted was the old profile. It was called SyncMaster.
Ah.
And I'm like, well, that's no good. So number one, I guess it the system, depending on what you're doing, will choose the last one that you selected, which in this case was the old monitor.
Sure.
So I highlighted VS248, and then all the colors looked a lot nicer. Then I'm like, you know what? There's all this garbage. There's all these profiles, and I don't want to see them. Like, I don't want to see the SyncMaster profile anymore. From what I can tell, the system automatically creates it when it detects a new monitor, and it puts it in your list. Well, I don't want that. And the thing is, Dave, that system preference screen doesn't have an option to delete, or at least the one that I had, the delete profile button was grayed out. Huh. I'm like, well, that's annoying.
Was it because you had to select a different profile for the monitor and then you could go delete it?
I don't know.
Okay.
So I researched online, and I'm not the only one that has this problem. So it's apparently just the way Apple does it.
Sure.
If you want to get rid of profiles that are for monitors that you no longer have or no longer need, you want to go to Library, Color Sync, Profiles, Displays, and you're going to see a list of the profiles from the monitor or monitors that you have or had. And if you want to clean that list out, you go there and you just whack the files.
And that's it. That works. Wow. Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah, it worked for me. I saw like two or three SyncMaster entries, and I don't know why. So I got rid of those. So just to keep the only things I see in there, I think, are default system things like Adobe RGB, generic RGB profile. I think those are built in and you can't get rid of those. But if you want to get rid of other, I guess, user created ones. Yeah, I'm very happy. I mean, I can see everything beautifully in Evernote now. I can see the list and, you know, the text on the agenda items is at a size where I can read it now.
Where it's reasonable. Yeah. Hey, that's awesome.
And it's great for gaming and stuff, too.
Yeah. Good stuff. Cool. Well, you know what I want to do is I want to talk about our first sponsor of the show, which is Connected Data, the makers of Transporter at filetransporterstore.com. In fact, that's the right place to go. So they make this little device that sits on your home network and essentially is your personal Dropbox. And the cool part, you get software for your Mac, software for your iOS device, software for Windows, and there's no setup required. You just plug this thing in and install the software, and you're good to go. It's pre-configured to do exactly this. And it's actually pretty amazing. And what's cool is you have your own Dropbox, but you can have separate folders and you can share those folders and you can share them with people that have their own Transporter, right? You know, so like you and I have a Mac Geekab folder that we can put stuff in, and Pete, you've got a Transporter and you're subscribed to that. But you don't see any of the other stuff I have, and I don't see any of the other stuff John has.
You don't think I do.
That's right.
Just kidding. Yeah, exactly. No, you don't. And that's the cool thing. Security on it's awesome.
Yep. And then even if you don't have a Transporter, you can share files. In fact, this weekend we had an offsite with the TMO staff out in Colorado, and it was actually gorgeous. We rented a little house up in Breckenridge, and we were talking about some movies, and Kelly wanted to share something that she had, and it was big, and we wanted to find a way to do it. She doesn't have a Transporter, but Jeff does, and I do. But Jeff just invited all of us, regardless of whether or not we had Transporters already, to this folder that he made called, you know, movies. And then she, when she got home, she put this thing in there and it instantly showed up on my Transporter, and I'm presuming Jeff's Transporter and all of that. And it works. And once you've got one of these, you can be the manager of the cloud for all of the people that you want to share documents with. So you don't need to have, you don't need everybody in your group to have one of these for you to benefit from getting one. And here's the thing. So you can get them, you can actually get them with no drive for $160, $159. And then you can get them with drives ranging from 500 gigs up to 2 terabytes. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, coupon code MGG75 saves you $75 off the 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte versions. And if I'm doing my math right, that means the 1 terabyte version is cheaper for you than the 500 gig version. And the 2 terabyte version gets a lot cheaper as well. So you got to check this out. Go to filetransporterstore.com. That's the easiest way to get there. You could go to filetransporter.com and then, of course, go to the store. But the coupon MGG75 is good at their store right online there. So you got to check it out. Thanks so much to Connected Data for being a sponsor of this show since, I believe, since their inception, in fact. So they're friends of ours, and the product is rock solid. You know, they've been around for a while. They've really perfected things, and it just works. I don't think about it, and it's great for doing things like this where you're sharing files, but big files, you know, multiple gigabyte files. Not everybody has cloud storage that's going to hold it. All you need is one of you, and then everybody else can. Yeah,
in fact, I'd like to share a quick use story of it. Just this week, I used to I'm doing a real estate deal, as you know, and I kept trying to email the file back to the real estate agent, and he couldn't get it. It was too big, so I put it in a transporter folder and shared it with him. And there it was. I didn't want to put it on Dropbox because it had social security numbers and bank account numbers on it.
Nice.
No problem putting that on Transporter because it's in my basement and he can link to it.
FileTransporterStore.com. All right, John, why don't you take us to Adam, if you would, please?
I can take us to Adam.
Sweet.
Uh-oh. Why am I getting this here? Oh, boy.
Well, I don't know. Everything okay over there?
Yeah, I'm getting an Evernote screen reminding me of something that I don't need to be reminded of here. So Adam writes, and I can see it in big, beautiful text. Guys, here's one I don't think that's been addressed before. Before upgrading the MacBook Pros in my office, I'd like to boot into the recovery partition and use this utility to make a snapshot of the internal drive or the primary user's home folder to a disk image on an external hard drive in case something goes wrong during the install. I've never needed to do such a restore, but better to be prepared and not need it than the other way around. Agreed. My problem is that the MacBook Pro wants to go to sleep after a time, and since it is not a full version of the OS, I can't tell it to stay awake, other than fabricating some small device to tap the space bar every 60 seconds. Is there a way to make it stay awake for the duration of the backup imaging? I actually like the solution of the proposed solution of making a small device to tap the space bar. I think we'll just end it here.
Huh.
No, here's how you could do this. So when you boot into recovery, which you do by holding down.
Can we stop for a second? I just want to.
Sure.
I like, he's got a tip here, right? There's a tip baked into this question. You know, he boots into the recovery partition and makes a snapshot of the drive or at least the user folder. That's an awesome idea. I mean, I like this. This is fantastic. So I just wanted to highlight that. I didn't want that to slip by in passing. That's a great tip, even though maybe you didn't intend it that way, Adam. So thank you. All right.
Well, you know, I like it too, because what I would do, Dave, is I would probably run Carbon Copy Cloner and make a copy live of my data. What this does is, because you're booted into recovery, that partition is not actively in use. So I would say this is the way to get the purest.
Yes. Total
version of a backup.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway, I just wanted to highlight that.
So here's the issue, though. Well, I was like, well, why don't you just go to system preferences and just go to energy saver and say, don't sleep? Well, that's the problem. Recovery doesn't have a system preferences. So what to do?
Well, but it still sleeps when you're in recovery mode. I didn't even think about that.
Well, one thing that bugs me is that it does sleep, because when you're actively doing something, I don't think the system should be sleeping. Like when you're actively creating a disk image. That doesn't sound quite right to me. Sleep is supposed to engage when the system is idle.
Is
right?
that true sleep? Or is it just monitor going
down? I don't know.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but you're right. Well, it's a hardware setting for sleep. So if recovery mode doesn't intentionally make a change to that, the system will just go to sleep.
Well, so, it does. Yeah. Now, how can you tell if you don't have a system preference? I'm going to tell you. So when you're in recovery, there is a utilities menu, and one of the utilities that you can choose is terminal. So what you do is you go into the terminal, and then you run the following command. So if you want to see what the settings are, Dave, and I did this under Yosemite. You type PM set, which is power management settings, space dash G. I don't know why they use G, but that lists all of the settings. And what I found, at least on my system, Dave, is that both sleep and disk sleep were set to 10.
Yep. Okay.
Ugh. Okay. Well, how do you set that? How do you make it not 10? Well, you go in there and you say PM set space sleep space zero. And that makes it so the system won't sleep.
Nice. Yeah, PM set's a cool thing. Alex in the chat room says, if you want to learn more about it, type man space PM set at the terminal, and it'll show you all the switches and commands and all that good stuff. And also, a BSD junkie in the terminal suggested a piece of software. It wouldn't work in this case because you can't run third-party software in recovery mode this way. But if you want to keep your Mac awake without changing your energy saver settings, you can use a piece of software from Lighthead Software called Caffeine. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And it does. It works really well. It just puts a little thing in your menu bar and you click it and your Mac will stay awake forever. And then all you do is click it again and it goes back to normal sleep mode. So handy little piece of software. Again, not doesn't solve this particular problem, but related and good. So good stuff. We got anything else on this one, John, or is it time to move on?
Yeah, that's about it.
All right. Well, then with that, I believe it's time to move on to Devin. And Devin says, I've always just used my NAS as a backup for iTunes and iPhotos, and my iTunes and iPhotos libraries, so I never worried too much about data loss or issues with the NAS. However, I know you mentioned once on the show the right way to store certain items on the NAS is with a sparse bundle. Should I be putting my libraries inside a sparse bundle and mounting them each time? This seems like a hassle with drawbacks in limited Synology integration, but I'm not sure what the risks are. Is it highly risky to have multiple computers looking at one iTunes library, or is that just that's just sitting in a regular shared folder on my NAS? So there's a couple of questions here. First of all, storing things on your NAS for the most part is totally fine. When you migrate from iPhoto to Photos, because of the way it does all these hard links and stuff, your best scenario is to have the data on your local drive so that it can do the hard links properly and then move the new Photos library back over to your NAS. But I've done it with iPhoto and I've done it with Photos on my NAS, reading directly from it, and there hasn't been a problem. We've got some stuff to share that some warnings about that, but I've done it and haven't had any issues with it. Running the same iTunes library though from multiple computers can be an issue, regardless of where it's shared from. So here's two use cases, and either one of them could get you into trouble. If all you're doing is storing your library there, which is what would happen if you went on two computers and pointed the iTunes library, you know, in the iTunes preferences, the data folder to the NAS, what can happen is that doesn't store your library files. So the things that hold your playlist, the things that hold all the metadata and the indexes of what you have are not stored there with it. So you're going to have two copies. If you've got two machines pointing to that same data repository, you're going to have two separate library files or sets of library files pointing to one data repository. That's going to get you into trouble, because if you add something with one, it doesn't know it's on the other. This has been the holy grail since the day we started this show that we've wanted to solve, and nothing really solves it. SuperSync kind of gets close, and that's probably your best bet. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, but if you're going to do this with the NAS, that's the way to do it, but it's really not optimal.
Well, so, go ahead. I've put everything in that iTunes library on my NAS drive and open it from there. Now it's a little slower across there, but when the other computer opens it, it goes to the NAS drive and opens it. And in theory, I think it's changing the database out there on the NAS drive, not opening it locally and pointing the data and pointing to the data over on the NAS drive. But
it doesn't, but
am I setting myself up for something I'm not aware of?
You are, because okay. I don't think you got to check. By default, it's not going to be putting your library files out there. It's just going to put the data out there. So it has no way of knowing. Okay. But you can make it put the library files out there. It's just not, it's not, but even then, if you've got two machines, you can't have two machines reading and writing the same library files.
Oh, right. Absolutely. But like the iTunes library and the ITDB files and all that, they're the XML file. They're on the NAS drive. With the whole library. And so that's kind of how I point to it. And like I have my server in the basement. And it's looking at a NAS drive, actually.
Oh.
But then my Apple TV is looking at that even
via your Mac Mini server.
Via my Mac Mini server.
That's totally fine. Okay. That's different. Yeah, the problem would be is if you had two machines
pointing. They can't open it at the same time. That I know. Because it just locks you out and says, hey, you know, nice try, but you're not looking at this because someone else is already doing it. Because
somebody else is in.
But right, if one machine is off, then the other machine can go in and use that iTunes library all day long.
It's true. You just got to be really careful of that.
Yes.
How did you move your library files over there and get them to stick?
Just cut and pasted them.
And it reads and writes from there?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's always done it for me. I've been lucky, I guess. Now, I have also, on occasion, tried to open it when the server has it open on my laptop, and my laptop goes, yeah, it's locked. You can't do that.
Yeah, so it's doing it.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
So I've been fortunate, but...
Yeah, it's not built to work that way. Yeah. Well, and you can get into trouble, but as you found...
Well, iPhoto used to let you open it both at the same time, and then you were totally horked when you, tried to save something.
That's right.
There you go, your photos.
And it's So we talked about this when Photos first came out, and Brian Webster from Fat Cat Software, which makes, he makes Power Photos, but he always made iPhoto Library Manager. He sent us a note. We were talking about Dropbox on that show, and he said the main issue with Dropbox is that there's no way to maintain a lock on the database. As Pete was saying, it's not built to do this, and if the files aren't syncing, the difference between Dropbox and a NAS drive is that your NAS drive is, if you have two computers pointing at it, they're going to see exactly the same thing 100% of the time. Whereas if with Dropbox, two computers syncing a file, especially if it's big files or lots of files, they're not always going to be synced up, right? Because it takes time for the syncing to happen. So there's no way to maintain a lock on those files and know that you've got things in one way or the other. So keeping your photo library in Dropbox, not so good. Transporter has a great way of syncing it, actually.
Oh,
And so that's yet another perk there for Transporter.
For
so
photos?
Yep.
Oh, well, that'll be good to know then, because I've got a lot of space there, and I'm waiting.
You do that, right, John? You have your photos synced to your Transporter, is that right? Or are you just doing your desktop folder and stuff?
No.
Okay.
Let me look here. No, let me look at my Transporter. So Transporter does offer, Transporter preferences, special folders. I have documents and music enabled, but not pictures.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. So there is that option there, but even still, you got to be careful that you're not trying to open it, in two different places at once.
Right.
That's the issue there. Brian goes on to talk about how he says as long as you're using connecting the right way. Now he says you need to be connecting over AFP, which is Apple's file protocol. That's not the current way that computers connect to each other. If two Yosemite computers will use SMB, but AFP AFP is typically what NAS drives are going to use anyway, as we found, even if they support both SMB and AFP. So you're probably going to be fine. I've reached back out to Brian to find out exactly why, what the specifics of AFP are and why he says that. But you don't want to get yourself into too much trouble there, Devin. But it is fine. If you're the only one opening that library, you can be certain. Like my wife and I have a kind of a meta library that we share that's stored on the NAS drive. She opens it most of the time. If I'm going to open it, I ask her, are you out of iPhoto? Okay, don't go into iPhoto. I'm going to go in. And we very intentionally coordinate that. For the most part, though, I don't go into that master library, and it keeps us safe.
And a quick tip on that, Dave, is I set up my notification center to let me know when I'm seeing new files hop in there.
Yep.
So I can tell my wife is editing photos in iPhoto. Now, I don't know about photos yet because I haven't fully transferred over yet.
Sure.
Because of an issue I had. But yep. But that's where you can tell the other person is open and they're editing stuff. And so I would always call and go, hey, are you done? So I could get in there.
Right. Yeah. That's the right way to do it. All righty. Let's talk about Mike here. And Mike has a great question. Mike asks, on an iPhone, is Siri and the dictation mic in the keyboard the same thing? In my mind, it's not. I turned Siri off in settings, but I can still do dictation in notes and other apps. They might share underlying code and hardware, but it seems to me text-to-speech is one thing, and Siri uses text-to-speech at a whole new level. But I've never seen the watch firsthand. Is Siri the only access to the text-to-speech engine on a watch? Is the distinction between Siri and text-to-speech totally blurred there? And is it correct to say that a watch app uses, or any app, uses Siri? Okay, so this is a good question, because I hear people confuse these two things all the time. In my, I agree with you that Siri is the engine that takes commands from speech and acts upon them, right? You can say, what's the score of the game, or, you know, search for this, or text Pete. You know, if I want to text Pete, I can say, text Pete, come on over at 4:45 so we can set up for the show, right? And it'll create a text message to Pete, and then actually the phone reads it back to you and sends it off. That's Siri. Dictation, or text to speech, which you hit when you're in, which effectively just replaces the keyboard. So if you're in notes or mail or something, or messages, and you hit that little text to speech button, the little microphone, you can dictate something. But if you say, if at that point I say, please text Pete, come over at 4:45, it will write out, please text Pete, come over at 4:45. Or it might say, please test Peach to come over at 4:45. Right. I mean, it, you know, sometimes gets it wrong, but when you're using the microphone, it's just taking straight dictation and it's not taking commands. So yes, they are two separate things, and good news on the watch, they are also two separate things. You have the ability to talk to Siri and issue commands and interact. And also, if the app allows it, you can dictate into the watch and have it actually just spell out text. And you can do that like in messages and things like that. One thing I will point out, though, while we're on this subject, in the car, I have found the Apple Watch to be a massive distraction. This was a surprise to me because I had a Pebble and I really liked, in fact, I thought it was safer in the car and found it safer in the car because I would get a notification. I wasn't tempted to, you know, pick up my phone or something. I just glance at my watch. I see the notification on the Pebble. I could do nothing more. There was no way to reply. There was no two-way interaction with these. And so it was fine. I'd see it and I'd drive. And if there was some problem or something, I could, you know, pull over or maybe trigger a phone call, you know, elsewhere, like from the dash or something. With the Apple Watch, though, there is the ability and therefore temptation to reply, because you can reply with text speech, right? So I can see, I get a text from my wife or something. I hit reply and then I dictate my reply, which is something I've done with the iPhone for a long, long time. And it works great, because what happens on the iPhone after you dictate your reply with Siri is it reads it back to you. It says, I will text, you know, Lisa. And then it reads out what you said, and then it asks, shall I send it? And you can answer yes. But on the watch,
dear God, don't send that.
Right. Yeah, Yeah. The problem with the watch is there's no speech. It just, at least the way mine's configured,
you've got to read it.
You have to read it. And so you've dictated this thing and now you have to read the watch. And I found it. I mean, I caught myself doing it. I was like, dude, this is terrible. So now I just don't. Yeah,
I've heard anecdotally, though, that the watch is serious, far smarter on the watch than she is on the iPhone. That's anecdotal. What's your opinion on that?
I actually have had good luck with text to speech in both.
Okay.
Yeah. So it may be microphone placement and all that. I wear my watch with the crown on the left hand side. I wear my watch on my left hand and the crown on the left-hand side. So not the classic watch orientation, but a far more ergonomic one, because now I can operate the crown with my thumb. The reason I mention this is the microphone and speaker are on the opposite side of the watch from the crown. So if you want a Dick Tracy style talk into your wrist, you are talking straight into the microphone if you lift your watch to your face with your hand up.
You're left-handed. You should wear your watch on your right arm.
I am right-handed.
I don't know. Why did I think you were left-handed? Okay.
I have a lot of mannerisms that that would indicate that I'm left-handed.
Yeah.
I've been told by several people that I probably should have been.
I just always assumed you were, but I never even paid attention to it. But
no.
That's why I wear my watch on my right arm.
Right.
I'm left-handed.
But. Yeah. But if you did that, the default would be that the crown would be
on the wrong side.
Still on the, it would be on the left. It would be toward your wrist or toward
be
your
nice
hand.
Nice if you could flip it upside and down and the orientation on it.
You can.
Knew.
Yeah, you do. You just set it in the app. You say I'm using left-handed crown or right-sided. Left hand wearing left side crown, right side crown. It's all right there.
It's beautiful. Okay.
Yeah. No, they thought about all this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah. Because otherwise the watch would be upside down.
Yeah, my knobs are on the wrong side on all my conventional watches.
Right. Oh, you wouldn't have that problem with the Apple Watch. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, okay. There you go. Now I got to go get one.
Now you don't have a choice. So there you go. Any thoughts on this, John?
I think you woke him up.
I know. I feel bad for John today.
John's having a rough
day. John doesn't usually get sick. He doesn't have kids around or anything to keep him, you know, well versed in operating through life with
keep his immune system active.
A permanent head cold. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think I'll make it.
Okay, good. I do want to talk about our second sponsor today, which is Squarespace. And Squarespace is an awesome engine. It's just fantastic what they've done. You go and visit squarespace.com. Please visit squarespace.com/MGG when you do this so that way they know we've sent you and they appreciate that. And obviously so do we. So you visit squarespace.com/MGG and you start by picking a template for the type of website you want to build. And then you just dig in further. And these templates are gorgeous. And you just go. In fact, do this now as you're listening, if you like. And just check out the types of stuff that they've built. These are gorgeous templates. And every one of them is what's called responsive. And that means that it looks good on a desktop, you know, full-size display. It looks good on an iPad display. And it looks good on a phone. It changes as you go from one to the other, as it should. You know, you don't want the full desktop experience on a phone. And these are all very fluid. And as the screen size changes, so does the layout appropriately while still maintaining your style and your theme. So you go and pick one of these templates and then you start going and customizing it. And you can put your own pictures in if you don't like their stock artwork. And it's just simple. You just drag the stuff in from the desktop into your browser and it works great. They really, really know what they're doing over there. And they've done a fantastic job just making this such a fluid process. And you know, you can, if you have a WordPress blog that you've been fighting with and it's been a headache for you and you don't want to deal with that, well, guess what? You can import all your old posts from your WordPress blog right into your Squarespace blog. So you just hop right over to it and you're good to go. Squarespace gives you 14 days for free to get your stuff set up and make sure that it's going to work for you. And then when you're ready to buy, use coupon code MGG because that way you save 10%. And this is cheap. Their plans start at $8 a month. That's, by the way, that's before your 10% discount from the MGG code, right? So $8 a month. And if you sign up for a year, which you're going to want to do, you get a free domain from them. So you get your domain registered and it's all just hosted there and it's all just handled right inside your web browser. That's the beautiful part about it because you're editing your website inside the same app that you're going to be viewing your website with. So you don't have to worry about FTPing. You don't have to worry about anything else. You just go and build your site and launch it. And then you can edit and post new stuff. And they've got great iOS apps, man. The new iOS apps that they have are awesome. You can post. I have posted blog posts. In fact, I think the most current blog post on my DaveTheNerd.com blog was posted from my iPhone while Lisa was driving us to Boston last week. And they've got metrics app where you can look at your stats and see what people are, how many people are visiting. And they've even got like a little notes app that you can just take little notes in and stuff too. They're all just gorgeous, really simple and elegant, beautiful stuff. So you got to check it out. Squarespace.com/MGG, coupon code MGG to save you 10% once you buy Squarespace. Build it beautiful. And that brings us to Giles, I believe, John. See how we do here with Giles. So Giles says, I've been using, I'm going to paraphrase what's going on with Giles here. So because it's a big, long trail that we've been through. Giles has two computers. He's got two iMacs, let's say. I think that's what they are. In fact, I'm not even making that up. And he's got a Wi-Fi network for his home. And that's how he gets on the internet. And that's how his computers can talk to each other. But he wants to transfer files quickly between these two iMacs. And they're next to each other. And so he thought, I'll use Thunderbolt Bridge, right? Thunderbolt Bridge, you see it when you have a Thunderbolt equipped Mac. You look in network preferences or system preferences network. And right there in there is a thing called Thunderbolt Bridge. And in fact, if you read up on this, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's treated as just another network interface. You plug Thunderbolt cables from two Macs into each other. They create their own IP addresses. And then you've got this super fast network between them. Problem is, even though Giles sets it up this way, it still transfers over Wi-Fi much, much more slowly. And we've been back and forth with this with Giles for a little while. The first thing, of course, that you want to do on both of those Macs is you want to tell it to prioritize the Thunderbolt bridge over Wi-Fi. And you do that by going into System Preferences, Network, hit the little gear at the bottom of the left column, and choose Set Service Order. And you drag the Thunderbolt bridge to the top. This theoretically will prioritize that. And you do it on both. And then theoretically, even though they see this, you know, each other on that, they'll do it. Well, that hasn't been working for Giles. And I think part of it has to do with Bonjour and how all of that happens, because he's just connecting to the machines as they appear in the sidebar, which is what you would expect. But when it doesn't work that way, sometimes you got to get a little more specific. What you can do is go in to network, system preferences network, and on one machine, look at Thunderbolt Bridge and see what the IP address is. And then go to the other machine in the finder, choose go, choose connect to server, and put in something along the lines of AFP:// or SMB:// depending on which protocol, but try it with AFP. It should be fine. AFP:// and then the IP address that you saw from the other machine. This will connect over that IP, and that should solve this problem, because you're not just telling it connect to that computer and letting your Mac decide which identity of that computer to use. If you put in the specific IP address, it's just going to connect to that IP. It doesn't matter what other addresses or network personalities that computer has. It's going to go ahead and put these right in there. It'll force it to go that way. So that should do it. If that works, Giles, what you might want to do is set your own IP addresses there, because the problem is these are going to change. These self-assigned IPs that happen when you just plug two interfaces into each other change, or could change, every time the computer boots up or every time you activate that interface. And that could be a pain in the neck if you've got to do it this way. So what you might want to do is set them both to a fixed address, or each to a fixed address in the same range. You've got to look and be careful that you're not setting it to the same range that your Wi-Fi is set to. But let's say that your Wi-Fi is set to 192.168.0.x as its IP range. Well, then for your Thunderbolts, you might set one of them to 192.168.1.x and the other one, not, you know, 1.1, and then 192.168.1.2. And then that way, you know, they're always fixed, and yet they're not going to overlap with the other things.
My question, though, about this is, should you also go into System Preferences Sharing and make sure that file sharing is checked on?
Absolutely. I kind of assumed it was, because he was able to share, just not over the right interface.
Over the Wi-Fi. Okay.
That's absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Stupid question time's over.
No.
There are no stupid questions, just stupid questioners.
That's right.
No, it was buried in the first pass of the question that he said, sharing is on, sharing is on.
Yeah. Right. That's true. Yeah. No, it's part of the, that's important. Absolutely.
Because that'll slow you down.
Yeah. Well, then it just won't appear. Right. Yeah. Any thoughts on this, John?
No, it gets tricky when you have multiple interfaces to try to prioritize them. So I'm with you. You got to force the hand sometimes and be very explicit in what you want to connect to.
Right.
Make sure it doesn't make the wrong decision, because sometimes it does. And I think you're right. It was like, oh, okay, I see that via probably Bonjour or something like that, and I'm going to use that connection.
Yep.
Oh, no.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, fun stuff, my friends. Shall we move to Andy? I think we should, right? Let's find Andy out here. While we're on the network side, Andy has an interesting question. Now, his use case is probably only Andy's, but it's an interesting thing. And my guess is that there's going to be enough of a, well, anyway, here we go. Andy says, at work, I use sound systems that are controlled by a Mac or an iPad over a network. Up to this point, I've always had one router and base station, but now things get more complicated. In my main rack, I have a Mac Mini, an AirPort Extreme, and an audio mixer, which is controlled by the Mac Mini or by my iPad. Simple enough. The problem is I'm in the process of buying another Mac or iPad controlled mixer. This one will not be installed in my main rack, and my current plan is to put another router, an AirPort Express, in with it, but that's open to change. If I'm only using the old system or the new system, then it's easy. They work independently as normal, and they need to work independently as normal. However, the problem is that sometimes they'll be used independently, and sometimes they'll be used together. I really want to set things up in a way that I don't have to reconfigure anything, not the routers, not the clients, not the mixers, and I just want them to work, whether I'm using both simultaneously or each one separate. It says, in my perfect world, the two routers would identify when they are both present and act as a single bridged network with IP addresses assigned by DHCP and also work fine with DHCP addresses when they are being used separately. But I can't come up with any way to do this. Do you have any ideas? I do have an idea. I think I've cracked this particular egg, but I have to make an assumption to do it. And that is, the assumption is that you can get an Ethernet cable between the two racks. If you can, then I have a magic answer that will allow both to operate on the same subnet and yet work. And the trick is to, I'll go through the steps, but the trick is to set them both up on the same subnet, but just slightly off from each other so they don't get in the way. And then it doesn't matter. So the first thing you're going to do is set each of them in AirPort Utility, other internet and connect, set each of them to static addresses. And set the IPv4 address of one of them to, again, you know, you're going to pick whatever range you want. But let's say it's 192.168.10. That's the range that we're going to use for this example. So you set one router to 10.1 and the other to 10.2. And then that way they will never interfere with each other when they're on the same network. Make the subnet mask on both of them 255.255.255.0. Leave all the other things blank. So now you've got two routers that can live independently or together on the same subnet. Great. That's step one. Now we have to make it so that they can give out IP addresses and not fight with each other about that. So in AirPort Utility, you go into network router mode and set both AirPort routers to DHCP only. This is like bridge mode plus, right? DHCP only allows you to hand out addresses, but otherwise all your Ethernet ports are the same. It doesn't expect to get any internet access or anything like that. It makes it handy. It's exactly what you want here. While still on that same screen, and this part's important, set one router's DHCP range to be, say, .10.100 to .10.150, and then the other router's range to, say, .10.151 to .10.200. The ranges are, you got to keep them below 250 and above 2 because you've got routers at .1 and .2. The size of the ranges, if you know you're only going to have 10 or 15 devices, maybe set it to just, you know, 20 on your range. The size doesn't matter. Just make sure they are not overlapping. So you've got one that's going to hand out addresses from 100 to 150 and another that's going to hand out addresses from 151 to 200. But the good news is that all of those addresses, because of the subnet mask, can see each other. So it doesn't matter which router hands your iPad an address, anything connected to both. Again, as long as there's an Ethernet cable between the two routers, is going to be seen. So you've got this perfectly bridged network. And then what you want to do is in AirPort Utility, go to wireless and set network mode to create a wireless network on both of them. That way they can operate independently. And then you use the same wireless network name and same wireless security for both. You can probably leave in wireless options .. There is a section where you can set the channel. If you want to set these to two different channels, so same name, same password, different channels, that's fine. You can probably, you're probably safe enough to leave them both at automatic on their channels. And that, that should get you there, because they do, they are smart enough to look around and grab a different channel. And then that's it. Then you plug in, make sure the Ethernet cable's there. And if it's there, you've got one network. It doesn't matter which DHCP server happens to jump first. It doesn't matter which one, which wireless, which router the, it connects to wirelessly, because you've got them all bridged together. And I think I got it.
Send Dave money for that one, folks. I'm telling you. If you've ever tried to run two routers, you know, it's like trying to invent a time machine half the time. I swear to God. So, oh, that's brilliant, Dave.
Right? I mean, yeah. I think.
It's simple. It's obvious and simple, but it's not obvious.
It's not obvious. No, at first when he wrote it, I was like, oh, dude. Like, well, hang on. This is where bullheaded persistence comes into.
No piece of plastic's going to outsmart me.
That's, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I don't think I'm missing anything. I don't think so. Anyway, John, what do you think about this?
I'm with you. The key is separating the DHCP ranges, I think, is a clever part here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, everybody's going to step all over each other, and it's just going to be a disaster.
It's going to be a disaster, right? Yeah. Yeah. So that you're right. That's the magic trick. The rest of it kind of falls into place by itself. But yeah. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, I think we have, we still have plenty of time here, of course. We talked in recent shows about bridging two distant networks together over Wi-Fi. And I've talked about my uncle up in Maine, and he's got those focused antennas and the routers, and it's doable and convoluted. And Chad says he has a simpler way.
Hello, John and Dave. It's your wireless buddy, Chad, calling. I was just listening to one of your recent shows where you were giving a writer some advice on how to extend his Wi-Fi network across the street to a little spot that he wants to extend things to. You're relating to your uncle's project up in Maine. There's an easier way to do this, I think. While your solution certainly does work and can be fun to tinker, you then start getting into problems where you got to keep your antenna cables relatively short because there's a fair amount of loss in there. You're kind of hacking something together with a lot of pieces of hardware that you might not need. Ubiquiti, UBNT.com, it makes carrier-class equipment that a lot of the wireless ISPs use, and it's relatively inexpensive. I think you could do this entire project for probably $200 or less. Getting all the hardware you need. If you want to look at their Nano Bridge, Nano Beam type equipment, they've got a couple other pieces of equipment in there. One looks kind of like a shoe, where it doesn't have a parabolic dish, but it's got just kind of a flat surface. You just point these things at each other. They're power over Ethernet, so you can put them up in the eaves or in a tree or on a pole. It's real easy. To mount and point these things. They've got external signal strength indicators on them. These software, they've all got individual web pages for configuration in them. It's pretty easy to navigate that and figure them out. And so you just want to put these things into bridge mode, point them at each other, connect them to your existing network, and you're going to be good to go. It'll be a lot easier. It's carrier-grade equipment. It's pretty proven technology. And out of the box, it's going to work instead of hacking together some hardware. And I think you'll find you can get this stuff online at Amazon, and each end is almost always going to be under $100 for the equipment itself. So just an idea, UBNT.com is their website. Ubiquiti is the equipment. Find the model information you want on their website, and then just go type that into Amazon, and you'll see thousands of reviews and suggestions. They've got great YouTube videos on how to set these things up. So I think you'll find that to be a little bit better luck for you.
Thanks, Chad. Man, Chad, you want to talk about smart networking guys? That's one of them right there. Chad is a Wi-Fi master. And I wish I could tell you about all the other stuff that Chad does. But anyway, it's fantastic. These things, and he sent us an Amazon link, those Ubiquiti. Let's see, the Nano Station M is $48 at Amazon. So if you if you need to start doing like real, you know, if your only option is to bridge wirelessly, this is absolutely the right stuff. It's like he said, carrier grade, and yet not expensive at all. You know, you're going to spend more than that hacking together the crazy, you know, antenna solution, I think. So it's good. Right, John?
I may get some.
Yeah. What do you need them for?
I don't, but.
Okay. Know. Yeah.
Because they're tech and they're cool.
Well, there's that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, John, you want to take us to Lars?
Why not? So Lars writes, hi, Dave and John. Greetings from an avid fan in Denmark. Wow. I've been listening to your show for about a year, ever since I bought my first and not last Mac, and keep getting useful info from it. I believe he means the show and not the Mac. Though it could be both.
Yeah.
I think it's both.
I think it's the show. Yeah. But that's okay.
Lately, I've seen some strange behavior with one of my Gmail accounts. It keeps getting the status inactive. And he pasted a screenshot showing that he gets a particular icon next to one of his accounts. Very often when I run mail, it will ask me to type in my password for this email account again. I do so and everything looks fine until the next time I wake my Mac from hibernation. Then it has lost the access again and I can start and I have to start all over. Any idea why it won't remember? Yes, I'm almost certain I know why it won't remember, Dave.
Awesome.
So you may ask yourself, how do I work this? But you may also ask yourself... No, sorry, I won't go down that path. All right, you may ask yourself, where are my passwords, my email passwords stored? It's a mystery. Where? I mean, you type them in, they're stored. They got to be stored somewhere. I'm going to tell you where they're stored. And I think where he should look, and I think where he will find chaos, because I actually found chaos recently when I looked at mine, Dave. So if you run Keychain Access, you're going to see you should on the left see two sidebars or categories, keychain and category. And under passwords, in all likelihood, what you're going to see, or at least what I see, Dave, and I think everybody should see if you have your email passwords stored. Well, you got to look carefully. So you're going to see name. You're going to see a name column. So once you click on passwords, you're going to see a name column. Then you're going to see the name of an email server. And in this case, it's probably going to be something like smtp.gmail.com or maybe imap.gmail.com if you're assuming that you're using IMAP. Here's what I think is a problem, Dave. And I just verified this in my keychain. Keychain or mail, I don't know who causes this grief, but you're going to start seeing multiple entries in there. And I think that's where the problem is. And I actually just looked at mine, Dave, and every now and then I'll come across this problem as well. And I think what happens is mail and keychain get confused and it prompts you for the password and you shouldn't have to type it in again. Once you enter it once in mail, and typically there's a checkbox when you enter any password, it'll say, hey, you want me to store it in the keychain? And you should say yes, unless you want to type it in every time, in which case you would not check that checkbox. But that's what I think is happening. Now, the other thing that could be happening, Dave, is that the keychain may be damaged or somehow corrupt. How do you fix that? Well, in Keychain Access, if you click on the Keychain Access menu, there will be something called Keychain First Aid. You run that, it's going to prompt you for a username and password, I guess an administrator. And there's two options, verify and repair. Verify is probably your first good choice, and repair if it detects damage. And that's what I got to say about that.
So you're totally right. If in fact his problem is that his password is stored incorrectly in the keychain, but I think he has a completely different problem.
I think I know where you're going, is that I've seen this on occasion.
Well, he's using Gmail.
Let me guess what you're going to say with Gmail. On occasion, what I see with Gmail is that, especially when you wake a machine, is that mail tries to make too many connections. And I think I've seen this. I don't know if that's where you're going, but
the issue is
that's what I've seen happen, in that too many connections are being made. And then what happens is Gmail barfs. Right. And if you click on the error message, it'll say, Sorry, too many simultaneous connections.
That's right.
Try later. Now, I still don't know why it's prompting for the password in this case. I don't associate that with the multiple connection problem. I think they're two separate problems, right?
I have seen it where the error that it throws leads mail to believe that it doesn't let it log in. And if it happens often enough, mail will say, I can't log in. Therefore, I'm able to connect to the server. I'm able to give it a username. I'm able to give it a password and it declines me. So therefore the password must be wrong if it happens too much in a row. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it could be anything. It could be, like you said, a damaged keychain, but the advice you just gave, click on the little, right next to the inbox or any of the mailboxes that it's trying to sync will be that little offline icon. When it's offline, click on that and it will show you the exact text of the error message. And if in fact you have too many simultaneous connections, it will say you have too many simultaneous connections. And that's where you can say, okay. And what you got to do is, mail app, especially in Yosemite, is not friendly with Gmail at all. So a lot of times what you need to do is just quit mail on all of your Macs. Your iOS devices are typically a little better in terms of this because they don't, they're mobile devices. So they're built not to have too many connections open at once. Quit it on all your Macs. A lot of times what happens is one Mac gets into a loop where it's just got a ton of connections open to Gmail and none of them are working in terms of doing anything productive except taking up your 15 slots. May seem like 15 is a lot. It's not, especially if you've got lots of IMAP mailboxes or in Gmail labels. So yeah, but that's good stuff, man. Good stuff. All right. Anything else on this one?
I guess the last one is you can also another place in mail to get useful info about why things are screwed up, though. I think in this case, you click on the icon and it says, here's the problem. There's always in mail, if you go to the window menu, connection doctor. That's another way to glean what's happening.
Yep.
You should see, if you run that, you should see all happy little green dots in the status column and then the account name and the account type and all that. And I think if you run that, I think you'll also see in connection doctor, I think you'll see the same error. Though I can't confirm that because I'm not running into that now.
You might. Yeah. The thing I do with mail is I leave the activity window open. So Windows activity, and I just leave it open on my desktop 100% of the time. And if
me too.
Yeah. And we've talked about this before. If it's empty or things are moving in there, great. But if you see things that look like they're stalled, guess what? It's because they're stalled. And that happens a lot with mail. So, all right, it's time to talk about iMazing, because those folks are amazing. From DigiDNA, iMazing is a piece of software. It used to be called DiskAid. It allows you to manage all of the media, the data, and even a lot of the settings on your iPhone. Have you ever had a song on your phone that you just wanted to take off of the phone? You can't do that in iTunes. You can see that it's there, but you can't copy it off of the phone. Well, you can with iMazing. You can edit your backups so that you can manipulate settings inside an app and then restore that to your phone if you want. So if you've got something where, we talked about this, like with that wireless mixer that I had, I needed to get settings off to it. iMazing is the way to do it. iOS 8.3 changed some of the ways that can happen, but iMazing caught right up and allows you to, you can't edit some stuff directly on the device anymore because Apple doesn't allow it. But with iMazing, you do it inside the backups. So you take a backup of the device and then you make the edit there, and then you can shoot the data back up to your device and get the data back where you want it to be. You can even do your backups with iMazing if you want. If you need to transfer files back and forth to your iOS device, this is what iMazing also does. It's just, this thing's absolutely fantastic. And you can archive off all your data. You can see your messages and your phone logs, all your pictures and videos, your voicemail, your contacts, all of that stuff. way easier than trying to manage this stuff inside iTunes. Not only is it easier, there's a lot of things you just can't do with iTunes. And you got to check this out. You got to go to iMazing.com and just download a copy of it, and you can play with it, and you'll love it. There's no way you're not gonna, you know, it just allows you to do all the things that you want to do with your device that iTunes just doesn't let happen. So you got to check it out. iMazing.com. Download a copy. It's available for Windows or Mac. Doesn't matter. I know most of your Mac people, and that's fine. But if you happen to have a Windows machine at the office and you want to copy songs from your iPhone to that machine, this will let you do it. There's no other way. You know, it's you can treat your iPhone kind of like a mobile storage device when you start doing this. It gets really handy. So you got to check it out. iMazing.com. Coupon code MGG saves you 20% off of iMazing when it is time to buy. And, you know, this isn't expensive. It's $30. So, you know, you're saving $6 right off the top there using coupon code MGG. You got to check this out. Go to iMazing.com. Let us know what you think. I think you'll be amazed. And with that, John, I guess it's time to take us to Michael, right? Because that's how it works. And I'll find Michael here somewhere.
Well, Michael, we have a trail with Michael, and I think some background is in order. I believe what he wanted to do was...
There is a whole big trail with Michael. You're right. But he's got, I think we can sum it up pretty quickly here. He had a bad drive in one of his machines, right? Correct me if I'm missing something, please, on this, but, I think we can go pretty quick on this. He had a bad drive, ran Disk Warrior on it several times. It came up bad. So he made a clone of this drive and was able to get his data and is now running from it. However, when he does runs a disk utility verify on this drive, he says, I'll read what he says. He says, it works like a charm for now. I made the clone bootable with SuperDuper. But as soon as I get a chance, I'll buy another 1 terabyte SSD and clone this one back to it. He says, but the problem is disk utility is still showing issues with the hard drive. Things like SUID files are modified and will not be repaired, that sort of thing. He says, my question is, should I clone this bad drive to the new drive and check it with appropriate utilities, or do something like a migration assistant or Time Machine backup restore to make the new boot drive? Are clones of bad drives also bad? That's really the crux of his question. And it's a good question, right? You know, you have this drive that's going south, you get your data off of it. How trustable is that data, specifically not just document files? Cause that's kind of easy. You look at the document. Is it good? Yes. Is it not? Right. But the replaceable data, the operating system, the applications, should you trust those when you come from a dead drive or a dying drive? And the answer is no, you shouldn't. You know, there's, especially if you're getting weird errors and that sort of thing. I think your best bet is to do exactly what you said, a migration assistant over, and put, you know, copy put a new OS on the new drive, and then Migration Assistant your data over, or manually copy your data over. Either way, if you want to clone back to the new one, I would then go into the recovery partition and reinstall OS 10 on top of it to at least get a known good copy of all the OS 10 files. So that's kind of the meta issue here. Was there something I missed, John, or something you want to add?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think the started is that he had a 2008 machine.
Right.
And wanted to take the drive from the 2008 machine and put it in a, kind of similar to what I did, put it in a 2012 machine. For whatever reason, it didn't start up.
Right.
One recommendation when that happens is to try to boot up in safe mode. And Apple even says this. I guess the thing to me is that there may be a point where the drive is the machine that a drive is coming from is so old that if you try to put it in a machine that's 4 years newer, it's not going to work.
Well, maybe. I mean, if as long as it's a it's the same type of drive. I mean, if you're trying to go from a machine that has ATA drives to SATA drives, that's obviously not going to work. Right. But if you're taking a SATA drive, it's just a SATA drive. But it sounds like his drive was on its way out.
Right? I guess that's the conclusion we're coming to, is that the drive he was coming from. Yes.
Yeah.
But is really, bad. The only thing I want to mention is that error that he did see. And I remember seeing this. So the error that he did see, that is not indicative of that message in and of itself. The one that says warning, SUID file, blah, 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 has been modified and not will be repaired. There's a specific support article, and I will put it in our chat room and I'll put it in the notes here. That message is actually annoying, but it doesn't mean that the drive is actually corrupt or damaged. That's just disk utility being lame.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Yeah, that error is not indicative of a bad drive. But if you know the drive was going bad, I think you want to only trust the data that you have to trust, which is your unrecoverable or unrecreatable documents, pictures, etc. But the system, there's no reason to live with, you know, a potentially damaged system file, even if disk utility doesn't identify it. Because disk utility won't identify bad files in that way all the time. Especially if you're just doing a, you know, permissions repair or something like that. Yeah. All right. You got one more you want to do today, John?
No, because that's a repeat pretty much.
All right, I'll get us there. I'll get us there. Let's go to
Dan, maybe?
Yeah, let's go to Dan. I like Dan.
I think I got something to add to Dan.
All right, sweet. Dan writes, I could use some expert help from you here. I have an iMac running Yosemite with one user account, the main one, of course, that gets stuck trying to log out, restart, or shut down. Listed below are some of the things I have tried, but so far nothing has worked. The system hangs when I try to log out. The only solution is to push the power button or bring up the terminal window and issue shutdown-r now. The system isn't hung and that I can open up other things such as console and terminal, but I can't use Finder. I've seen interesting things when looking in the console log. I see messages coming from CloudD and SandboxD where it is having trouble with files that don't exist, I think. In particular, files in library containers, com.apple.star, many Apple things, library caches, it's saying are not there. There is not a caches folder. When I look on my MacBook Air, a different machine, I do see a caches folder at that level. This may not be a problem, but is something I have noticed. And he's tried doing all kinds of things, deleting preferences, deleting different caches, repairing permissions, starting up in safe mode, which works correctly and does, in fact, let him shut down. Signed in and out of iCloud, all of that good stuff. So those cache folders should be able to be created. Anything in home, library containers, com.apple.say/preview/data/library should have a caches folder. And on his machine, it's not there. The first thing I would do, so he said he repaired disk permissions, which in fact, is fine, but doesn't impact anything in your home folder. So I would repair your home folder permissions, which can be done a few different ways. We'll put a link to an article that explains how to do it. It used to be that we had an app called, Yasu, right? YASU that let you do that. I don't know of any other apps that will do it at the moment, although I'm sure one exists.
Onyx?
Will Onyx do your home folder permissions?
I believe they added that option. It's buried in there somewhere. I believe they did add that out. Let me poke around while you pontificate.
Well, great. We'll put a link to an article that shows you how to do it the Apple way, which requires going into recovery mode, but at least it works and works on every OS. But hopefully Onyx can do it, because that way you don't have to reboot, and that'll get there. So that's kind of the first thing I would do is do that. Failing that, and I believe that did fail, in fact, for Dan here, I would go and manually create that caches folder and then take a look at your logs and see see if it complains again, and just recreate all the cache folders that you need to. and see what happens, right? You know, are you able to even create them, or is there something else going on? Is there some sort of, although again, this should be reset when you do that, but you know, the ACLs, which are sort of the extended permissions and all of that, should be reset when you do that. But maybe not.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Despite my sickly state, my memory has not yet failed me. Although right now I'm feeling something in my ear. Oh man, I hope I don't have an ear infection. Those suck, man.
That stinks.
I don't know what I did wrong. I
interacted with the public.
I blame New York City. I went to Manhattan and went to a trade show with all the huddled masses. It was one of the huddled masses. I blame you, huddled masses, for getting me infected.
Was this when we went together? Or you went?
No,
again?
No. I'll talk about it here. Okay. But again, I'm you know, losing it. I'm incoherent. But mm-hmm. No, I went to CE Week for 2 days. Or it could be that I had to wake up really early to go to CE Week. But yeah, I went to CE Week for a couple of days.
Got it. Got it.
Well, they had video and audio and cars and all sorts of tech goodies. I'll report on it.
All right, sweet.
But the good news is Onyx. So you start up Onyx, maintenance, permissions. There's a little checkbox. Reset home folder permissions and ACLs.
All right. That's
so
the
Onyx provides a nice interface to do this.
Sweet. Yeah, that's the magic answer then. But again, if that doesn't work, you know, start trying. I'm glad we got to remember this Onyx thing. But
the other thing that I think, and I don't think it, I believe this still happens. I'll have to verify this, but I believe, Dave, if you start up in verbose mode, not only when you start up in verbose mode will you see all sorts of chitter chatter, mostly textual, indicating what's happening, but I think in this case is a perfect opportunity. But I also believe when you shut your system down, you will get additional textual chitter chatter, and I'm almost certain it's going to highlight versus the console. I think it'll highlight exactly where it's getting all confused.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, if it gets to the point where that happens, that's right. Oh, I like that.
So I would suggest, starting up in verbose mode, because the thing is, shutdown -R now is not something I would recommend you do on a regular basis.
It's better than hitting the power button, because it does shut down the system.
Not much.
Right? Oh, yeah. No. Wait, whoa. I will. I definitely disagree there. I mean, the power button just kills the system. Shutdown -R now kills your processes without issuing an official quit. Right. And maybe, you know, and this is why this is an interesting thing. Right. But it also shuts the system down properly. It flushes all your caches. It shuts down the OS in a very friendly way. It actually restarts. -R is restart, right? Whereas -H would be halt, and that'll actually power it down.
Let's see. Man, shutdown -R, the system is rebooted.
Oh, correct. Okay. Yeah, but you get, I mean, it's not just a power down. It doesn't yank it out from underneath it. In fact, sometimes a shutdown -R now will take, I've seen it take, you know, 5 minutes as it flushes caches and does what it needs to do. But that it's way better than hitting the power button. Not as good as shutting down the right way, but way better.
Okay, no, I think, okay, no, you're right. The -R is better. I think -H is the one that you
No, you can do that too. The only difference between -R and -H is that -H will not restart after it finishes, but it's the same process. Except -R then restarts and comes back up when you're, you know, when it's done, whereas -H halts.
Oh, so what you're saying is shutdown is an elegant way of
it's more
elegant. It's better than holding down the power button.
Correct. Yeah. It's not the preferred way, but it's better. Yeah. Which is why I sometimes will SSH in from a different Mac. If my Mac is totally munged, I'll SSH in from my iPhone. I'll use like prompt or something to issue a shutdown -R now, because at least it's better than hitting the power button. You know, if the mouse is the mouse and the keyboard are, you know, non-functional and all that, if you can get to a terminal, any terminal on your Mac, even from remote, and do it, it often works. I've often thought that would be a great idea for an app. In fact, you know, that just logs in via SSH to your Mac and issues a shutdown -R or a sudo --shutdown --r now. I don't know. That would be a good idea. I think I like it. All right. What else do we got here? Is that, we got anything else on this, John?
I think that's it.
All right. Well, then, it's time to bring in the band. Don't you think?
I think.
We're going to do more questions. Come on.
Hey, yeah. Come on, man. I got to get better here. I got to take the doctor's advice.
That's right.
We had one of the doctors in our chat room recommend that I... What did he recommend? What
bourbon.
Medicine?
Better
he
living through chemistry.
Ah, he said bourbon or whiskey, I think was whiskey. What he
okay.
said.
Okay.
Better yeah. living through right, chemistry. That,
I may have to take the advice of the doctor.
Doctor said you're going to do it, John.
Yeah. I don't think Doc Rock is actually a doctor. He's a nice guy. He's not a doctor. So
oh, just on the like internet. Dr. Bob. Same with Dr. Bob.
Just like Dr.
Very
Bob.
Smart.
Not
He's
a doctor.
Not a real doctor. Remember that, folks.
That's right. He plays one on
TV. Ask
on
for credentials before. Ask for credentials first.
That's right. And kids, remember this out there. It doesn't matter if it's your doctor, your dad, or your dealer advises you to do something. You choose what you put into your own bodies. It's an important message. I know it sounded snarky, but it's not.
It's kind of message. Obvious, I think. I
mean, well, let's hope, right?
Is there ever a case where you don't choose what you put in your own body?
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, a lot of people just blindly follow the advice of one of those three or someone else.
Oh, all right.
You know, it's not good. Anyway, so there's your real advice for today.
Now,
feedback.
We're not... I was going to say, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Go ahead. Take it, man.
We're not doctors. Though we kind of like to think we know what we're talking about. In which case... If you want a prescription to soothe your ills, you can send an email to feedback@macecab.com.
Yeah, that's feedback@macecab.com, folks.
Wait. Who was that? Was that feedback@macecab.com?
That's what they say. That's right. Premium@macecab.com for all of you who are premium subscribers. We certainly appreciate your direct support and are happy to prioritize your questions, although we do try to get to everything. Premium@macecab.com is one of the perks that you get being a premium member and supporting what we do here. And we really appreciate it. Check it out at macecab.com. Anybody can pick up the phone, though, if you want to leave us a voicemail and call 206-666-GEEK, which, John, do you remember what that is?
It's a phone 4335.
Sorry, I walked in.
That's all right. John, where else can they find us? Where else can they find you? Where else can they check in on you, my friend, to make sure that you are on the mend?
My favorite is the Twitters. I'm almost on the almost always on the Twitter, and I try to read my entire timeline and respond, especially respond if people message me directly or do a at reply. And how do you reach all of us on the Twitter? I'm going to tell you. It's twitter.com. I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. He is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab, and the publication is Mac Observer.
You got it. That's right. You did it. You remembered. I want to thank Michael Johnston. He converts most of these shows. I think last week didn't get converted. And this week we're actually going to try something different just for the sake of trying something different. But that doesn't mean we don't appreciate Michael's work. He's the host of the iOS show. He makes GetAppler, GetAppler.com. You got to check these things out. The iOS show is awesome. So thanks, Michael, for all your hard work here. We appreciate that. Adding all the chapters and everything. Also, in fact, I'll tell you what we did today. It's fine because the thing's still going. Pete and I took timestamps while we did this. And so we're going to push this out right away and see how many of you notice that we did the chapters a little bit differently today and how many appreciate the slightly less involved chapters and yet the faster turnaround time. So that's what's happening today is the AAC will go out as soon as the show is finished. So we're trying that. It was a little much. If you noticed a little bit of distraction here, well, part of it was John's cold and part of it was that I got everybody to manage, but part of it
input.
Was that
multiple inputs.
Pete and I were trying to come up with a new workflow here. So anyway, that's if anybody has any ideas about logging timestamps mid-show and all that stuff, we would love to hear it. We think we've got something good, but it can always get better. I was thinking of using Keyboard Maestro, Pete.
Oh, yeah.
If I could somehow get Keyboard Maestro to pull data from the timer that's going on the recording, I could just go into the little file and hit one keystroke, and it bam, the timestamp, it drops an anchor, and we're out. Yeah. Right? And then I don't have to look and think and paste and type and right.
Yeah, so it's one click.
It's one click, yeah, exactly. So that's the thought. So I get it. If anybody knows Keyboard Maestro really well, I don't know. That's what I'm thinking of. All right. Anyway, that's it. I want to thank the folks at Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for all the bandwidth that it takes to get the show from us to you, because that's important. The podcast marketplace, of course, includes, as we mentioned in the show, iMazing at iMazing.com. Coupon code MGG saves you 20%. Squarespace, build it beautiful at squarespace.com/MGG. Coupon code MGG saves you 10%. Connected Data, the file transporter store.com. MGG75 saves you $75. It's a great deal. Also, the folks at Smile at smilesoftware.com. Linda at lynda.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. And, of course, the folks at Barebones. Software at barebones.com. John, I'm going to have Pete give advice, because it's important that we give you advice today. So Pete, what is it that you might want to share?
You know, it's been a long time since I've been around you guys, and I don't know what the heck you've been up to, but I've got to tell you, you've been pretty good about it, because I haven't seen anything on the internet about it. So you have followed advice from past shows. Well, you didn't get caught, and all of you out there, don't get caught.
Made up.